UK Wine Show, show number 38, Jamie Good on the Science of Wine. G'day, and welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 38 for the 16th of February. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're going to be talking to Jamie Good, wine blogger and writer. Jamie is going to be talking to us about three topics this week. His website, thewineanorak.com, which is one of the UK's top wine blogging sites. His current book, Wine Science, and his new book on natural wine. The Wine Science was actually one of my favourite books from last year. It cleared up a few things that I couldn't get the answer to. So we'll be having a great conversation about that and natural wine, if there is such a thing. As many regular listeners know, the show is sponsored by 3050, the wine tasting company. And if you've listened to a couple of podcasts recently, you'll know that I'll be running a series of four wine tastings on Tuesdays in March near St. Paul's Cathedral. If you attend all four tastings, they cost £80, and if any of the other tastings as a one-off, it's £25. Tickets are selling pretty steadily. We've got about three or four tickets left for each of the days now, so it's going quite well. Normally at this stage, give the wine news, but I thought I'd just give you some great news that we've had. As you may or may not know, Jane Scott, the person who reads our news, is actually my wife. And very early this Saturday morning, Jane gave birth to our second baby girl called Natasha. Jane and Natasha are doing well, and Jane feels up to being able to do the news for this week. So, without further ado, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. UK drinkers have more diverse tastes when it comes to wine than consumers in the US, according to new research. Wine Intelligence looked at the drinking habits of consumers in the UK and across the Atlantic. Results showed that in the UK, people not only drink red and white wine, but they are also more likely to indulge in rosé, champagne, cava, port and sherry, compared to their American cousins. In a straight red versus white contest, UK consumers tend to drink more white than red, while in the US, red is more popular. As far as white grape varieties are concerned, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Grigio are universally popular. In addition, the Brits head for Chenin Blanc and Semillon as alternative whites, whereas in the US, drinkers tend to go for Riesling. With reds, Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon are the top varietals in both countries. After this, UK drinkers plump for Shiraz, Tempranillo and Grenache, whereas the US tends to opt for its homegrown Zinfandel. Richard Halstead at Wine Intelligence puts the UK drinkers' diverse tastes down to a more mature market. But our transatlantic friends certainly have a taste for wine. They consumed a record 300 million cases of it in 2006, and wine has now edged ahead of beer as the country's favourite drink. Next up, wine lovers can spend a weekend getting a real taste for Bordeaux at a special event being organised in France this May. Le Weekend de Grand Amateur is designed to allow amateurs to taste like the experts, as well as meet the men and women behind some of the great growths in the region. The weekend programme begins with a tasting on Saturday the 12th of May. Over 100 châteaux are participating, including Château Lynch-Barge, Pichon Longueville and Haute Bailly. In the evening, there's the chance to have dinner at a château in the Médoc or in Graves, Sauternes, Saint-Emilion or Pomerol. The following day, the château will open their doors to offer visitors a personalised vineyard tour and tasting. Anyone interested in the event should check out the website bordeaux.com. Finally, in the news this week, a London wine merchant had around £20,000 worth of champagne stolen after a break-in at Baltazar in Fulham. Director Charles Meyrick told us the thieves were quite selective in what they took, so he reckons that the bottles were probably stolen to order. Among the haul were a long list of premium champagnes, including 40 magnums of 1990 Veuve Clicquot, 36 bottles of 1990 Louis Roederer, and two Girobermes of 1975 Perrier Jouet Belle Epoque. Also taken were 11 bottles of 97 Krug, which Charles said he found quite painful to lose. Several vintages of Cristal were also removed, though amazingly they left behind the 1979 bottles that look a bit cloudy. Charles said the thieves didn't leave any fingerprints, but they are still going through CCTV footage. And 70 years ago, on the 13th of February 1937, the first meeting of the Australian Wine Marketing Board was convened. The board met for the first time to consider future policy, and it was said to mark a new era in the Commonwealth's attempt to maintain prices and enhance the goodwill of Australian wines in the British market. That's all in the news for this week, Chris. Back to you.
Thanks for that, Jane. I don't know if the comparison of styles that consumers drink between the UK and US is a fair comparison. After all, the US produces a fairly large amount of wine. You know, most countries that produce their own wines don't tend to import large amounts of foreign wine. Fair enough, the US does bring in a lot of wine, but they do drink a lot of their own stuff, and rightly so. You know, I live in the UK, I think we should be trying UK wines here. Given that the UK industry is still quite a fledgling industry, it's fairly understandable that we still have a lot of imports of wine, but perhaps that will one day change, and you might find that the UK is just known for drinking sparkling wines. Next up, let's have the interview with Jamie Good. Hi, I'm here with Jamie Good from The Wine Anorak and the author of the Wine Science book. How are you, Jamie?
Good, yeah.
Excellent. How did you get into the wine industry?
I kind of crashed the party a bit. I did a PhD in plant biology. And after that, I went on to be a science editor working on academic science books. And during this time, I started drinking lots of wine. And I got interested in the subject to the extent that I started a website. And as the website grew, set in my interest, and then I started writing for a few magazines, and the whole thing kind of snowballed from there.
When did you start doing your wine? It was Wine Anorak, your website,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
WineAnorak.com.
Yeah, Wine Anorak started in the late 90s. It started from a very small base, and then as I decided to grow it, I decided to put more effort into it, and WineAnorak.com in its present incarnation started in 2000.
And how many people go to your website?
It varies. I guess in terms of page views, we're up to about 230,000 page views a month. In terms of unique users, which could be, as you know, with website stats, there's website stats and there's website stats.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
but in terms of the individual kind of computers that log on every month, around 60,000. But then, of course, one person might be using two computers to access the site, or one IP address might cover three or four users from the same company. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, no, it's pretty hard to work out that. We have the same problem with the podcast. Your book, The Wine Science, when did it come out? It's been out for a while now.
Yeah, Wine Science came out in the UK in November 2005 and in the USA in March 2006.
So it's been out for a while. It's a very good book. I really, really enjoyed it when I read it about 6 months ago.
Nice of you to say so.
More than welcome. You can say anything nice about me anytime you want as well. What I liked about it was that it's got some depth to it. It covers some issues and enough to really just give you a good feel for what the issues are. Maybe not answer the issues, but at least you feel competent to be able to engage in a debate because you feel like you've got the good background information there.
You know, the idea behind Wine Science was that I wanted to pick, you know, maybe 20 or 30 of the most interesting issues for me in the world of wine and then look at them through the lens of science.
Yeah.
So, for example, terroir. Now, terroir, I think, is just a really interesting subject. But when people use the word, they mean different things by it. Mm-hmm. And there's also some notions about terroir that I think are a little bit unscientific. And so my idea was to go in there primarily as a wine lover who interested in sort of diverse wines and, you know, understanding, you know, why wines taste a certain way, and to use what knowledge we have of the science of how grapevines grow and how wine is made to then unpack issues like terroir. So I guess if you read the chapter, I want people to come away not with sort of like dogma, but with more questions, but being able to kind of inform the sorts of ways they think about these subjects with the science that's available.
Yeah. You made an interesting comment about there's a lot of people who don't understand necessarily, they don't come from a scientific background in the wine trade. There does seem to me, my background's engineering, so I'm a bit of a science-y type person as well, I approach it similarly. But there is two types of people in the trade. You've got your artistic, flamboyant type of people who really science is something that other people talk about. But they're into the wine from a more artistic point of view, and they look at terroir and the wine and all that sort of stuff from an artistic point of view. And then you've got the science-y type people, which are more like your Australians and your Kiwis and things like that, perhaps. Do you think that's a fair comment?
No, I think it's a good comment. But what I was trying to do with the book wasn't to, it's really not to be a scientific fundamentalist. It's quite easy to take, say, for instance, an issue like biodynamics and just slaughter it, because there's so much about biodynamics is talked about by people who use a almost a different language, a different level of description for the phenomena they're looking at. So, you know, they'll talk in a rather flowery, esoteric language that scientists just don't have any real way of relating to.
Yeah, holistically.
And they'll talk about topics in, you know, and in a very pseudo-scientific sort of way. So scientists would typically come in and say, well, it's all nonsense. But I'm actually coming at it from a... I try to come at it from the perspective of, yes, I'm a scientist, but also I'm a wine lover as well. And so I try to bridge the gap between the more artistic, flowery, literary types in the wine world and the more sciencey types, and to bring some sort of fusion of ideas. I know it sounds a bit pretentious probably, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, no, that sounds pretty good. I think it's about right as well. The tone of the book is you feel like you do need to know a wee bit about science to read it comfortably. I found it quite approachable and easy, but that's because I've got that sort of background in science. Do you think that the more flowery types could read your book? Is it written... Do you think it's written at a level for them to understand it?
Yeah, I hope I didn't take too much scientific knowledge for granted. I might have done, because obviously if I'm immersed in science all the time, then you use jargon without even realising it. But the goal of the book really was to make it accessible and to make it interesting to people who don't have a scientific background. I mean, it'd be very easy to write this book for other scientists. And in fact, when it was sent out for review by the University of California Press, who published it in the States, the first two reviewers came back and really laid into it, because it wasn't a book for scientists. But I'm actually writing a book for people who are interested in wine. And I guess I'm asking the question, look, there are some really interesting wines out there. Why is it that they're so interesting? Why is it that wines grown in a certain place are much more compelling and fascinating than wines grown in another place? And so that's kind of my motivation for using science. I'm not using science for its own sake, but I'm using science, you know, in effect to see how science can help us to make more interesting wine.
The book's won quite a prestigious award. Which one was that?
Yeah, it was very funny. It won the Glenfiddich Award in 2006 for the best drink book. And, well, I say it's funny, I was really chuffed. But I was just really surprised that an award like that would go to a book with the title Wine Science. But I'm thrilled that it did.
Yeah.
I think it's just very encouraging.
Yeah, no, for sure. And sales have been going well?
Yeah, it's like with book sales, it's almost like a website statistics. It's kind of hard to be sure sometimes. From what I can see from the sales reports I get, which are kind of like 6 months after the event, it seems to be selling okay, yeah.
And it's still selling quite well?
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you get it from? Amazon, obviously, but is it in any bookshops?
Remarkably, it's in... I've wandered into quite a few Waterstones and Borders and looked through the drink section, and there it's been. Okay. And I even found it in a bookshop in South Africa as well, so it's kind of fun.
Very good, very good. Have you got any other books that you're planning at the moment, or is
I've got a book project I'm really excited about, which is it's a book on natural wine. Now, that probably needs some explanation, because it's a book that I'm doing in conjunction with Sam Harrop, who's a winemaker and a consultant. And the idea behind the book isn't that it's going to be a bit of propaganda for the advocates of biodynamics or organics or any other sort of camp of natural wine producers, but it's looking at the subject of, you know, where the wine industry is now and the issue of, you know, is it appropriate to add things to wine? Is naturalness an important concept for wine? Does anything go as long as the wine tastes good? And I think we feel quite strongly that the idea that wine is natural and traditional, whatever that means, is quite important for the way that people perceive wine.
So you talked about adding things to wine. What about removing things from wine, like you can use reverse osmosis, strip out water or flavours, finings to remove tannins? Is that all part of this?
Yeah, I think it's going to be something we're looking at, because I think that any winemaking involves manipulation. Wine doesn't make itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to do something to it. At the very least, you've got to crush the grapes and then transfer the wine from various containers to other containers. But we'll be kind of examining the way in which technology can be used appropriately in wine, and whether anything goes, or whether there should be limits on the sorts of manipulations that you make. And I guess on one level, it's not that, you know, that all these manipulations are just tools. And as with any tool, it's not necessarily the tool itself that's important, but it's the motivation with which you use it.
Or the final objective,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, the final objective, yeah.
Yeah. I noticed, like, for example, last year, some South African winemakers were pinged for adding flavours into their wines. You know, and there was a bit of an outcry, but there was a good debate about whether that was an appropriate thing or not, because putting a wine into an oak barrel is adding flavour effectively.
Yeah, I guess it's slightly unsatisfying to say manipulations are okay or additions are okay as long as they're traditional, because it seems like you're stopping wine in time. You're saying, well, this is what wine is, and we can't develop it or evolve it anymore. But at the same time, the South African scandal was around adding methoxypyrazine, which are flavouring compounds. Although they're found in wine, they're flavouring compounds. And the big problem there was that once you start adding flavouring compounds to wine, it gets very difficult to draw a line in the sand and say this far and thus no further. And that's a big problem, because then you could be adding fruit flavours, fruit essences, yeah, and all manner of things.
Yeah, sure.
And that could be extremely damaging to the future of wine, I think.
But even so, putting things into oak barrels and picking that up, toasting the barrels, they all influence the flavour of the wine. And
yeah,
in effect, they're adding flavours to the wine. You know, Bordeaux producers don't get uptight about their barrels simply because they're trying to control micro-oxidisation. No,
that's a good point. And what we're saying, effectively, when we look at natural wine, is that there's a continuum. It's not just a wine is natural or wine is unnatural. There's almost like a continuum. So the further you go on the continuum, the less natural wine becomes. And I think the industry's really got to decide where to draw the line on this continuum as to what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Because otherwise the boundaries will just be pushed further and further. I guess it's a slippery slope argument. But what we could end up with is a product where wine is effectively a manufactured product. And the problem then is that wine could go the way of beer. And the whole beer industry has really stagnated in recent years. And if there's not something special and unique about wine, then I think that could be damaging to the whole venture.
Well, thanks very much, Jamie.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Jamie. Next week, we're going to be looking at fair trade, since it's Fair Trade Wine Week coming up soon. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.